a good day for bird watching. Every day is a good day for bird watching. So let's talk birds and bird watching with the state ornithologist, Dr. Margaret Rubega, professor of ecology and evolutionary behavior at the University of Connecticut. Margaret, good to have you back. Thanks for coming in today. And let's talk about a combination of birds and bird watching this morning. And for starters, how about bird flu? How serious an impact did bird flu have here in Connecticut?
Well, bird flu was only documented in birds in Connecticut about 6 months ago. And that's not to say that there was no bird flu in the state. It just means that someone found some dead birds, took them to the pathology lab, and got it confirmed that there were definitely, that they'd been killed by high pathogenicity avian influenza. It's serious everywhere that it turns up because it's highly contagious among birds. And more serious than that for most folks is probably that it also turns out to be quite contagious to a variety of other mammals. So, for instance, cats can get this flu from birds. And when they do get it, it tends to be fatal very, very quickly. So it's a good reason, given that we know that the flu is out there and in the state, it's a pretty good reason to keep your cats indoors. Because if your cats are outdoors, they're stalking birds. If they happen to come across a dead one especially, they're going to play with it. And no one wants their cat to get sick and die. But more than that, it's actually been shown in a couple of cases that cats, once they have it, can give it to their owners.
Do you feel that we have passed the peak of that, or is it still at the level it was several months ago?
It's a little hard to tell. The peak, the term peak sort of suggests that it's going to crest and then die out and go away. Just offshore of Connecticut and up the coast, seabird colonies have been hit by HPAI for the last 2 years straight. This past winter, there were a lot of ducks out in the Sound and, again, north of us who washed up and were dead, who tested positive for HPAI. It is not likely to just peak and go away in the short term, but how long it's going to go on for is a little hard to tell.
Margaret, you're the state ornithologist. What does that mean?
Ooh, well, it means in this state, let's see, it gets me a cup of coffee at Starbucks for $3.50 anywhere in the state, and it gets me a lot of phone calls, and sometimes it gets me a whole bunch of trouble. And what I mean by that is, so the position was actually established by the state legislature in 1918. There's actually a statute, it's still on the books, that says that the person at what was then the state agricultural college who teaches the ornithology class shall serve without additional pay, that part's important, Wayne, as the state.
No free coffee.
There is no free coffee. Shall serve as the state ornithologist and advise the state legislature on matters of importance relating to birds. And, you know, establishing such a position at that time made a lot of sense. We were a much more agricultural state at that point. Birds were considered agricultural pests. We were also a major center of egg production. So lots and lots of chickens in chicken houses. If you drive around in the state and you look back into the woods, you'll see these long two-story buildings that have largely been abandoned. Those were egg production facilities, chicken houses.
We all love watching birds, some more than others. I'm pretty high on that list. But was that your situation when you were a young lass? Were you really into this as a young child? When did you become really fascinated by birds?
Great question. I was not fascinated by birds when I was a small child. I don't have, so many people who become fascinated by birds have what I like to refer to as the collector gene, right? They have that urge to to collect things. And it might be baseball cards, or it might be Pokemon cards, or it might be just a list of bird names. And once they discover that birds are this very diverse thing, the collecting of seeing them becomes sort of compelling for them. That did not happen to me. When I was in high school, I had one truly fantastic marine biology teacher. Her name was Mrs. Page. I went to Fitch High School in Groton, who got me very excited about just natural history as a way to think about the world. And through my association with that class, I got taken to a field station at the American Museum of Natural Histories that's on an island out in the middle of Long Island Sound. It's a tern colony. So there are...
T-E-R-N.
T-E-R-N. Yeah. They look kind of like gulls, but they're smaller and pointier. I just became completely entranced with the way birds have their own existence. Right next to ours, there are these remarkable, incredible things going on all the time. And when I say that, I mean that about every single bird. We look at birds and think, oh, it would be great to be a bird. We just imagine ourselves as a smaller person with wings and able to fly. And it's not like that at all. They're really inhabiting a completely different world in a sensory sense. They have all these capabilities that we don't have.
One thing in the ornithology world that has been quite widely discussed in the last couple of weeks has been hummingbirds, the northward migration of the ruby-throated hummingbirds. And some people have seen them, some people haven't. And I didn't see a lot of hummingbirds last year. Where do you think the hummingbird migration is now, and are we seeing as many as we used to?
I'm not aware of a decline in hummingbird populations. In terms of where they are at the moment, hummingbird migration is managed, is sort of controlled, as all bird migration is. The reason they decide to start moving northward is they have this series of hormonal cascades that make them restless and make them want to move that is brought on by a change in the length of the day. That is layered on top of that is the availability of food. So as they migrate northward, they're basically following the wave of trees and flowers beginning to bloom, which makes nectar accessible to them. And they will tend to show up at a given place at a given time, depending on the availability of those foods. And we've really altered their distribution a fair bit by learning to put out hummingbird feeders, which people love to do because, of course, then you get to see these incredible birds much closer than you might otherwise.
Can you identify exactly how they eat from those hummingbird feeders or from flowers they find around? I've seen the video of it, and people see the beak stick into the feeder, and they figure, well, it's just being sucked up to the beak. No, there's a long tongue that comes out and goes deeper in the feeder.
Yeah, no, their tongue is, when you see that long beak, you should imagine inside of it a tongue that is equally long. And in fact, all the parts of the tongue are longer than the length of the beak. The bones that control the tongue actually exit out the back of their jaw and have to wrap around the back of their skull up onto the top of their head for them to have enough space to store them. So those bones, when they're shifted forward, push the tongue all the way out of the beak, and they can extrude their tongue out of their beak almost as far out of their beak as the length of the existing beak itself, right? So when they fly up to a flower, they poke their beak into the flower, but it's really only the tongue that is picking up the nectar. And the tongue is constructed in this very particular way. First of all, it's split at the tip. So there are two ends. And the ends, when they're at rest, are sort of curled up in a shape that's kind of like an ice cream cone. And when the ends of the beak actually touch the surface of the fluid, because of a physical interaction between the materials that the tongue is made out of and the surface tension in the fluid in the nectar itself, those tongue tips roll open and spread out. You can think of it almost as though they've got little hands stored at the tips of their tongue. And then when they pull them back out, they roll back up again and the nectar gets trapped on their tongue. They also have long channels in a pair of channels that sort of like little ditches that run all the way up the length of their tongue. And when they're sticking their tongue out, they're squashing those flat. And as soon as the nectar reaches those, because it creates a release of the pressure that's holding them shut, the fluid sort of jets up those little ditches and fills their whole tongue. Plus, they've got these little fingery things on the end that have rolled up to hold the fluid on the tongue so that it doesn't fall off from gravity as they pull their tongue back in. They pull all that back into their mouth. And then the next time they stick their tongue out, they squeeze it again. They squeeze the tongue again, and that squeegees all of the fluid, all the nectar off the tongue. And then it gets pumped up farther up their beak and to where they can swallow it. So sometimes you'll see a hummingbird, it's drinking, and you can see its throat pumping. And then it'll back up and take its head away, and you'll see them flick their tongue out and back a couple of times. They're doing that last set of squeezes to clear all the nectar off of their tongue so they can swallow it.
And I read, a hummingbird burns so much energy that it uses torpor, a kind of hibernation light, to avoid starving to death before breakfast.
Yeah. Yeah, they absolutely do. A hummingbird has a, you know, sort of a core body temperature. The for me and you, it's 98.4 is about where the sweet spot is. For a hummingbird, it's about 105 degrees. And they're tiny, so they have a lot more surface relative to the interior of their body. So they're bleeding heat all the time, in addition to the fact that they're doing this very, you know, impressive form of flight that involves hovering. So their wing beats are really high. Their metabolic rates are sky high. And so that just burns a whole lot of energy. And if they don't lower their metabolic rate, lower their heart rate, lower their respiration rate overnight, they will run out of energy. And that's that. Sometimes you'll come across them if they've gone into torpor and it's a particularly cool morning, so they haven't been able to warm back up yet. Sometimes you'll find them hanging upside down from a branch, kind of zoned out. They seem like maybe they had a little bit too much fun last night.
Hungover, yeah. For people who would like to draw more hummingbirds to their feeders, obviously the sugar water, which most people know about, but are there other things we can do around hummingbird feeders to attract them to the area so they get to the feeder?
They're really dependent on flowers. And red flowers in particular are super attractive to them. So planting good nectar-producing, by which I mean sort of tubular kinds of flowers, penstemon, things of that nature, will tend to attract them to your yard. They'll still use the feeders where you can see them because a feeder is like a super flower for them. The flower is not producing nectar in the kind of unlimited volume that a feeder has in it, but the flowers will attract them.
Do you occasionally find hummingbirds around reddish flowers, even in the wild, even if there's no feeder around?
Oh, absolutely. You have to remember that hummingbirds evolved before there were any feeders to be had. There are whole populations of hummingbirds that have no access to feeders ever. Yeah.
I'd like to ask about apps that identify bird calls. I use the Merlin app on my phone. I used it this morning, and it picked up robins outside my place. When I got to the parking lot here, it found the northern cardinal and it found the tufted titmouse. But which app do you recommend for people that want to be able to identify bird calls? You don't need it because you know them all, but some of the rest of us are still figuring this out.
Well, sometimes I still need practice there. You know, it's been a long winter. You step outside, you hear something, and you think, that's going to come back in just a minute. It's like somebody's name, right, that you've known for a long time. Merlin is actually a really great choice. I think it was produced and is constantly being updated and upgraded by the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. They have an enormous set of resources with respect to existing recordings of bird voices, and so they also have just a tremendous bench of people who understand how to do the analytic work to take all the variation that comes with you're standing on your front porch and there's a car going by and there are actually three birds singing, but two of them are very far away and one is very close. What that app is doing is the result of the work of folks at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology figuring out how to make the computer program focus on the vocalization you're most interested in, and then account for all the variation in bird song, right? Maybe your bird only did part of the song instead of the whole thing, and they still have to compare it to their sort of reference songs to give you an answer. And one of the reasons to use it is because as a big nonprofit that's focused on citizen science, the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, every time you record a bird and you get an identification, they're also collecting that recording and adding it to their background database, and that just helps the app improve and also helps them identify what's happening to the ranges of birds in North America. Because if you heard a northern cardinal in a place where it hasn't been heard before, that's information that we need over time.
It's the app I use, the Merlin Bird ID app. Let's talk eagles. I've talked about the eagles that I watch on live cameras often on the air. And just for the radio audience, I'm wearing a T-shirt that I got from the Friends of Big Bear Valley in Southern California, which has the two parents, and it's got the eagle, which fledged a couple of years ago, named Spirit, which I was really, really attracted to. But in general, Margaret, what about the eagle population in Connecticut? I hear that it's doing well and it's expanding. What are your thoughts on eagles in Connecticut?
Oh, you hear correctly. When I first started working at UConn in 1998, it was a big occasion to see a bald eagle in the state. I think probably most folks know that the eagle population was really dramatically depressed in the earlier part of the 20th century. When we started spraying DDT around in order to control the mosquito population, because, you know, mosquitoes carry diseases. But
what I heard was the DDT compromised the quality of the eggshell.
Exactly. And so it made eggshells very, very thin, and both eagles and ospreys were sort of the two big poster children for this, excuse me, because they're fish eaters, and so the fish were concentrating the DDT in their body tissues, and when the eagles ate it, the females were producing eggshells that were very, very thin, so that when they tried to incubate their own eggs, they would crush them, and that would kill the developing chick. And so the population plummeted. Once this problem was worked out, we went through a period of time where there was a campaign to, you know, eliminate the use of DDT in the country. Rachel Carson's books really had a large effect on that particular fight.
Silent Spring.
Yep. Yeah. But at that point, the populations were so depressed that eagles were put on the endangered species list, and they're really very much a success story of the Endangered Species Act. If we had not used the Endangered Species Act to protect the few birds that were left and were still capable of breeding in a healthy way, we wouldn't have the population that we have now. And in fact, they've been taken off the endangered species list because the population has recovered. So now they're, I don't want to say everywhere, but it is now becoming almost common to see them. Their population has really boomed.
Where do you see them? Do you see bald eagles in the wild?
Oh, I do. I see them. You can see them on the Connecticut River, of course. They tend to gather there in the wintertime because it's a big enough body of water that the ice doesn't cover it over completely and they can still keep fishing. But they also breed along the Connecticut River. They're almost certainly breeding somewhere in Mansfield Hollow.
Right by the junction with Mount Hope River. I've seen that tree.
Yep. Yeah. They are probably breeding on the Willimantic River, though it's not clear to me at this point where. I mean, I have had in my very own neighborhood, I live in the Eagleville neighborhood of Mansfield, and at the traffic intersection of Route 275, South Eagleville Road, and Route 32, just sitting in the tree over the intersection watching the cars going by underneath, they're It's a fantastic thing for me to see them at because of how rare they were when I first started looking for them.
Now, I'm really big into these eagle cameras. I talk about it on the air from time to time, the live eagle cameras, not just the one at Big Bear, but there's a couple in Florida and a few other ones. In fact, one in West Virginia got blown down a few weeks ago when a microburst came through and three chicks died and two parents did survive. But you, as an ornithologist, do you watch live eagle cameras or live bird cameras, or is that like, you know, you do this every day? Maybe you don't need to do that.
Yeah, I have to say, I'll occasionally look at them, but I'm kind of busy looking at live birds directly, so I tend not to get on the cams quite as much as some folks. But the cams are a wonderful thing in that folks who might not otherwise have the mobility or the access to the places, you know, where the birds are breeding get a chance to really, you know, see up close and personal the bird behavior and the development of their chicks. It's just fascinating.
Margaret, you mentioned ospreys, and there actually is an osprey nest down the right field line of the baseball park at Recreation Park in Willimantic. You have to kind of know where to look because you're almost looking straight up. But could you just give a quick little classroom session on the differences between eagles and ospreys? They have similarities, but they're not exactly the same.
No, they are definitely not exactly the same. One big difference is that an eagle is much more of a scavenger, frankly. They do fish for their own food. They'll take fish directly out of the water, but they'll also scavenge food that they come across. If something is dead in places like Alaska where bears are pulling fish up onto the riverbank, they'll come in and try and take it off of them. Benjamin Franklin thought that eagles were really kind of disreputable characters because of their willingness to scavenge. An osprey, on the other hand, doesn't do anything except go after its own food, and it has a different technique to the way that an osprey catches fish. An osprey will fly over the water until it sees a fish, and then it will plunge straight downward into the water and usually will go so far into the water that the water often closes right over its head, and then it surfaces again and it'll have a fish in its talons. So it can take fish that are a little farther below the surface than an eagle can. Eagles will fly through, they're after fish that are right at the surface, and they'll sort of grab them as they fly over just from the surface, but it's much more uncommon for them to throw themselves whole body straight down into the water the way an osprey does.
Yeah, the eagles kind of do more of a skim while the osprey comes almost straight down. They're quite interesting how they do hunt for fish. Margaret, anybody with the bird feeder in their back or front yard knows where this question is going. Squirrels. Do you have any advice for people on how to keep squirrels away from your feeders?
Well, the squirrels indeed. Let me just put in a plug for the squirrels. I myself bird feed and Do I love how much seed the squirrels take? I do not. Do I love how they tend to scatter the birds off the feeder when they're up there feeding off of it? No, I do not. But we'll give them a moment of silence or a couple of seconds of silence for they're just doing their own job making a living.
How about the role of pepper when it comes to bird food?
Yeah, that is one technique, and it actually can work very well. So if you feed suet, it's possible to buy suet that has hot pepper mixed throughout it. And that'll keep the squirrels off because, just like us, pepper produces a burning sensation in their mouth. They don't like it. They'll leave that food alone. But birds...
Not of the bird's mouth, though.
Right. Birds do not have those taste receptors. And so to them, a chili pepper just tastes fruity, the way sort of a plain sweet red pepper would taste to you, only more so. And that's because the plants that we're talking about, peppers, they're making fruit in order to get certain kinds of animals to come and eat the fruit and take their seeds somewhere else and spread them around. Now, some of the animals that eat their fruits do that very efficiently for them. And then other animals that take and eat their fruits are what are called seed predators. Either their digestive tract destroys the seeds or they pull the thing apart and drop the seeds right underneath the parent plant, and so the plant gets no value from them. So in an evolutionary sense, over time, plants have evolved this system of including these chemicals in their fruits that make them hot and spicy because they don't want mammals to eat their fruits, but the birds are good dispersers, so they targeted those chemicals for the receptors that the mammals have. So that'll work in your feeders if you put out that. It's a little harder to do with seed unless you get specially treated seed, because you can put cayenne, like in just loose cayenne pepper, in your seed feeder, and that'll help. But unless it sticks to the seeds, it tends to sift down through the feeder, and they can still get seed out of it that doesn't have much burn to it.
I find the pepper suet cakes to be very effective. You see the squirrel get to the cake like, oh, here's lunch. And the second they touch it, bang, they head the other direction really fast. A listener asked me this question to ask you. Why is bird brain a derogatory term? They are smart, the way they build nests and so forth. Do you have any idea where that came from? I bet you've never been asked that question before.
I have been asked that question before. I think the answer to the question is, you know, resides in our tendency to focus on just a few kinds of birds and not pay attention to the diversity of all the birds there are. If you, just like people, some of them are what we recognize as smarter than others. Some of them can do things that we can do without any trouble. Crows, ravens, blue jays, all very, by human standards, very intelligent. And I keep saying by human standards, or the way we think about intelligence, because every single bird is extremely well-tuned to do what they're supposed to be doing in life. So whether you think they're dumb or not because maybe they don't recognize themselves in a mirror does not mean that they are not living their best life and fulfilling their ecological role in the world. Where the term comes from, I don't actually know, but I would guess it comes from we have domesticated birds that are not inconveniently intelligent for us. Chickens, as birds go, are not particularly smart. Pigeons, which have been domesticated in a lot of cultures for food or for racing or for message carrying, again, they have really remarkable capabilities for things like homing. But in terms of you give them a problem to solve, maybe not so much. And so we're just more familiar with their intellectual capabilities.
I did a quick Google search, and it says the origin of the term as an insult is unclear, but we recognize it as a pejorative which leans on the relatively small brains of birds. So it's more about the size than it is about the capacity of the brain. I think they're brilliant, but that's, you know, probably an opinion that you share. Margaret Rebega is our guest this morning, the state ornithologist. You just mentioned birds seeing themselves in mirrors. People sometimes have problems with feeders near windows, like big picture windows, and the birds fly into the window. How can we, because they sometimes get hurt, sometimes they die. What can we do to slow that or prevent that?
Yeah, actually, it's a very, very large problem, especially on big skyscrapers with a lot of glass on them. At this time of year, many hundreds of thousands of birds are getting killed by flying into glass. And that's because the glass is reflective, so it looks like more sky. And they just keep going. And if they hit it hard enough, indeed, they'll get internal injuries and end up dead. The trick is that folks will sometimes go, say, to, you know, a nature center, and they'll be selling decals to sort of show, you put this on your window and it'll show that there's something there. The mistake a lot of folks make is that they put those decals on the inside of the window, but the mirror is on the outside. The mirror's on the outside. So you've sort of taken a sticker and put it on the back of a mirror where no one on the outside is going to see it. You really have to do the treatment on the outside of the window. And if folks are interested in solutions to that are good, especially for, you know, home use, you can go to the American Bird Conservancy website. They have a lot of information there about how to prevent bird strikes at your house and some links to distinct products. But you can, you know, do things that are very low tech. It turns out, because birds can see in the UV range of light, if you take a common highlighter marker and use it to draw lines that have to be fairly close together, you need to draw a grid of lines on the outside of your windows, they'll see that and they won't hit the window. The problem with that, of course, is that it wears out, it washes off, you have to keep reapplying it. There are a lot of products on the market actually now to apply to the outside of your windows that still allow you to a perfectly good view out, but that keep the birds from hitting the window.
I was reading up on Margaret last night, and I discovered a site on the UConn website, the story called Flocking to Stores, A Birder's Tour of Campus. And anybody that's a birder that wants to see birds in the wild, you should read this, because it basically was quoting you this, that, and the other. Started at Horse Barn Hill, went to Mirror Lake, went up to North Campus. So maybe just a little summary that, especially on the UConn campus, the quote was that you said, birds are everywhere.
They are. They are everywhere. We're sitting here in the WILI studio, and I just pointed out the chimney swifts outside over town to Wayne. So it's absolutely true that they are everywhere. And the UConn campus, just because it has a lot of open space and it also has a diversity of habitat on it, tends to be a pretty good place to go wander around and look for birds. The Horse Barn Hill area in particular is kind of nice because it's the agricultural school part of campus, and so there are big open fields, and on the open fields there are bluebirds, there are red-winged blackbirds in the little wet marshy area just north of the dairy barn, there are kestrels in nest boxes that some state folks who are working to help kestrel populations have put up. There are lots of pigeons. I know people like to hate pigeons, but pigeons are super interesting. I'm telling you, they're interesting birds. Barn swallows in and out of the horse barns. Those are good places to go. Mirror Lake, usually at least once a year, has an osprey come through, fish for a couple of days, and then move on. But you really can walk around anywhere, and if you just look, you'll see birds.
On that website, I saw, people should not disdain pigeons. Pigeons can find their way home blindfolded while flying. Says here on the website, Professor Rebega is an expert in the functional ecology of feeding in birds and the anatomy and biomechanics performance of wild birds. So we're talking wild birds this morning. Margaret, you mentioned chimney swifts that you saw outside my window this morning. What do we need to know about the chimney swifts in Romantic Willimantic?
Romantic Willimantic, well, chimney swifts might be the very expression of Romantic Willimantic. They're overhead all season long. Chimney swifts are fantastic birds. People tend not to know them as well as they might know some of the birds in their yards because you only see them when they're flying. They're not capable of perching on a branch the way most birds would, and that's because their feet have sort of evolved into these grappling hook structures that allow them to hang on vertical surfaces like the inside of a chimney. Though they originally evolved as a sort of a cavity bird, they used to go inside hollow dead trees. And so there are quite a few of them in Willimantic because Willimantic has all these incredible, great old buildings that still have brick chimneys in them that they can get down inside of. The Nathan Hale building on Main Street has a very substantial roost inside of it during the migration season. And there are quite a few birds in there all the way through the summer, actually. When people, you know, think to look up at them, they look like little fighter jets. They have these sort of backswept, very pointy wings. And if you really pay attention to their flight capacities, honestly, they make some of the birds people make a big noise about in terms of their flight capacities, like peregrine falcons, they make them look like kind of clumsy. They're just fantastic birds. And they're very interesting in the way that they go about their biology. Again, they can't really land on a tree, so they get sticks for their nests by flying by the tips of branches, grabbing them as they go by and breaking them off mid-flight. Sometimes they'll flutter around, you know, hover around the edge of the tree a little bit, but they can't do that for long. Then they take them back to the inside of a chimney and stick them to the wall of the chimney and to each other with their spit to make a nest. They just are unusual in so many aspects of their biology. They're just really interesting birds. And there's also another roost, which is to say a place where a whole lot of them are coming and going in about the period about 20 minutes after sunset when the swifts are here. You can see them going to bed in there. They'll tend to circle the building, circle the building, circle over the building. And then something gets them to decide. We think it's the light levels. And a whole lot of them will go into the chimney in one very short period of time. They look kind of like a backwards tornado going down into the chimney.
Margaret, do we have an inordinate number of turkey vultures in Willimantic? I see them all the time.
We have a very healthy turkey vulture population, yes. I don't know that I would say it's inordinate. We have the number of turkey vultures we have because even with the buildings we have, this area is still to a large degree sort of, you know, there's a lot of open space. It's still fairly rural. And so there's space for them and there's a lot for them to eat. I can sympathize with anyone who has a turkey vulture roost set up in their yard. At the same time, they're doing a really fantastic job for us. Our bills for running around and picking up roadkill would be much higher if there were not turkey vultures in the world. They are cleaning up the dead stuff that gets left behind, among other things, by our cars.
Carry on.
Hitting things, right.
Yeah. And we talked about hummingbirds early this morning. Sandy wrote and said, I'm fascinated by her talk today, especially about hummingbirds. One area that you wanted to talk about, though, was feeders in general. And especially with bird flu going on today, maybe not so much hummingbird feeders, but what should people know about putting feeders up when there still is a threat of avian flu?
Yeah, you know, folks are always excited to put up feeders because it brings birds where they can see them. And there are, you know, many species of birds that it's quite helpful for, especially in the winter time when it's cold and there aren't so many food sources. The feeders are important. The feeders are somewhat less important for the birds in the summertime when they're largely looking for insect or other kinds of invertebrate food. They have to feed their kids protein sources, so those feeders are not helping them with that. And when you get birds to congregate in one place, you are increasing the risk that if there's a sick bird in the group, that they're going to pass it to the other birds in the group. This is true not only for avian flu, it's also true for conjunctivitis and some other diseases that birds can pass to one another. And so, you know, one approach to being sure that you're not facilitating the passing around of the flu is to, and I know this is disappointing for folks who love their feeders, you could take your feeders down. But if you're going to leave your feeders up, the important thing to know is to make sure that you're being observant. If you see sick birds at your feeders, the feeders really do need to come down. You need to pay attention. If you come across dead birds in your yard, you absolutely positively should not touch them. You could put on a pair of disposable gloves, put it in a plastic bag, seal it up really tight, throw those gloves away, and then, you know, take it to the pathology lab at UConn. But do not touch dead birds yourself. And you should be cleaning your feeders on a regular basis, regardless. Even if you don't see sick birds, it's important to keep emptying the feeder and washing it good, sanitizing with maybe a weak bleach solution, and then putting it back up again. But you need to make sure that you rinse it really well, because especially if you used, for instance, a bleach solution on a hummingbird feeder, you don't want that to end up in the nectar you're putting in there. For nectar feeders, especially when it gets warm outside, you need to be taking those down every couple of days, emptying them out, washing them good, and then starting over again. In the heat, you put out sugar water, it's going to ferment, and then you end up with drunk hummingbirds, and nobody wants that.
And we talked about the issue with squirrels and bird feeders earlier this morning. What is your opinion on people greasing the pole to the bird feeder? I've heard that's not a good idea.
It's not a great idea. First of all, squirrels are pretty smart is not exactly the term I want to use. For you, the squirrel is an inconvenience. For the squirrel, access to the seeds is a matter, you know, in some degree of life or death. They're going to keep looking for solutions. But if you grease the pole and you end up with a greased squirrel, it's very hard for a squirrel to clean that kind of thing off of their body. It exposes them. Because their fur is not going to work the way that it's supposed to, it's going to expose them to cold temperatures in a way that they otherwise would be able to handle because their fur is matted down and not acting as a good insulator. It's more effective generally to make sure that you locate your feeders far away from, you know, more than a leap's distance away from the nearest bushes, the nearest trees, the nearest structures they can climb and jump down onto your feeders from. Put it on a tall enough pole and put a squirrel excluder, one of those, you know, cones like the cone of shame you might put on your dog. They make them to go on the feeder pole. And that does a pretty good job if it's high enough off the ground to keep the squirrel from getting up to the feeder. There are also a variety of feeders you can buy. These are powered. You have to keep putting batteries in them. But as soon as the squirrel weight goes on them, they whirl around and throw the squirrel off. But you can also just run a clothesline or something similar to a clothesline between two trees that are not especially close to each other. Hang the feeder in the middle and put spinners that the squirrel can't get past without being dumped off on the line on either side of the feeder, and that will also keep them off. But that, you know, that's a certain amount of engineering, and some people, frankly, learn to enjoy watching the squirrels figure out how to get around their defenses.
Well, there's the 9-5-4 rule for squirrels and bird feeders. designed to deter squirrels. It suggests placing feeders at least 9 feet from any overhead branches, 5 feet off the ground, and 4 feet away from structures like fences or trees where squirrels could jump from. You can look up the 9-5-4 rule. You talked about greasing a pole and getting it on the squirrel's fur. What about ancillary contact with bird wings for that grease?
Well, that is also a problem, but that sort of depends on exactly how your feeders are hung. If the feeder is at the top of the pole, that's a little less likely, but it is an issue. And bird feathers, grease and bird feathers really do not mix. A bird feather is constructed in a way that requires a lot of little tiny components of the feather to line up exactly into a sort of a mesh. And when you grease it, those little components stick together, and that lets water through, it lets cold air through. And as I said earlier, birds have much higher body temperatures than we do. So what to us feels like a very warm 75-degree day is still a day on which they can lose a lot of body heat and get hypothermic if their feather coat is not clean and intact.
Margaret, if this radio thing doesn't work out for me and I decide I want to go to UConn, can I get an ornithology degree? And if so, what would I do with it?
We don't actually have an ornithology degree, but we do have ornithology classes, Wayne, and you're welcome to come sit in on the ornithology classes anytime.
I just had one this morning with you.
Yeah, or you could just get me to come back, and then we could work our way all the way through the material in my ornithology classes. If you came to UConn, you could get a degree in any one of the biology disciplines. We have a straight biology degree. We have a degree in ecology and evolutionary biology, which is the department I am in. And if you were interested in studying birds, you would take the ornithology classes as well as some other classes in ecological concepts and evolutionary theory. We try to turn out graduates who have a well-rounded background in biology and ecology and evolutionary biology in general. And then you might go on to, say, work for the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, protecting birds in the state. You might go on to work for one of the nonprofits that does bird conservation. You might go on to work for a zoo. You might go on to work for a museum. You might go on to work for a nature center.
Audubon.
You might go on to work at a university the way I do, doing research so that we know more about birds than we did when we started.
I like your idea. Let's bring you back every year and talk birds. This has been a lot of fun this morning, Margaret. Good to have you back talking about birds and bird feeders and avian flu, even eagles as well. Margaret Rubega, professor of ecology and evolutionary biology and the state ornithologist on 14 WILI Willimantic and 95.3 FM.